Hi, David Finkel. Welcome to KABU.
Glad to be here.
David Finkel is the editor of the journal Against the Current. He's a prolific writer and trustworthy analyst. Hundreds of pieces on U.S. and international politics. He recently wrote on the war in the Ukraine and the global crisis. Its banner recites Russia out of Ukraine, solidarity with Ukraine's people, no to NATO expansion now or ever. So, David, that piece recognizes the inspiring resistance of the Ukrainian people. It ends envisioning a revived peace movement. And in the article, you comment on how this war and its reverberations are overshadowing the absolutely urgent need to deal with climate change and its threat to human life. More on that combined movement, peace and climate action, later in the interview. First today, though, your article discusses the roots of the conflict and rival imperialisms for Russia, who wants to maintain their sphere of influence throughout Eastern Europe and Western Asia and stop the encroachment by NATO. And the U.S. and its off-and-on European sidekick, especially the U.S. with its far more ambitious project, it wants to reign supreme over the planet and over space, and that includes supremacy over China. That's sure to resist U.S. domination in coming years. And needless to say, it's a program to dominate and profit from its control of the international economy and its structures. David, tell us all about it.
Okay, obviously, a number of huge topics. I think this situation has dramatically changed the world as we knew it over the past 30 years. I don't think that's an overstatement. Let me just say first that when you talk to Ukrainian people, and I've been to, there was a great demonstration here in Detroit over the weekend, a couple of thousand people pouring out from the Ukrainian community. There was no anti-Russian chauvinism, okay? There were plenty of signs denouncing Putin, some of them rather off color, but there was nothing that resembled hatred of the Russian people or anything like that. Let me also say in passing, it's very important that we say Ukraine, not the Ukraine, or just as we don't say the Lebanon or the Argentine anymore. It's Ukraine, it's Lebanon, it's Argentina. People are sensitive to that, believe it or not. It's very important to them that the reality of their country and their nation is recognized. And Putin's attempt to deny that has been refuted in a very dramatic way by the power of the Ukrainian resistance. So I would say that, yes, this touches on everything. It touches on the world economy, which looks like it's being reshaped. There's an economic war against Russia now. The sanctions are more dramatic than I think we would have anticipated, and I think go beyond anything that Western governments or the United States originally intended. I think the power of Ukrainian resistance has changed the equation dramatically, and we absolutely do need to be in solidarity with that resistance. The invasion must be stopped, must be defeated. We can talk later about how it might end, but that's a big blank canvas at the moment. You mentioned that this is overshadowing in the daily headlines the climate disaster, which according to the new IPCC report is getting dramatically worse more rapidly than expected. It's crowding out things like the refugee and humanitarian disaster that has overtaken Afghanistan, or refugee disasters and displaced persons disasters in other parts of the world, because what people see now as the immediate focus is over a million people fleeing from Ukraine in conditions that are horrible and getting worse. So, yes, it crowds out our attention on a lot of things, but it is right now. The war in Ukraine and Ukrainian resistance are the center of world politics right now in a way that is dramatically changing all kinds of things and all kinds of assumptions that we had grown to make.
Yeah, one of them, it has some, it seems to me, very positive implications, but it also has one immense negative implication, which is it's somewhat like the first war against Iraq and driving them out of Kuwait. It seems to me it's led to, it's got the potentials of triumphalism at this, of saluting the CIA and the military, of making the U.S. look omnipotent. And here it's not even been forced to send any forces in. It seems to me it's also, as you've written, empowered NATO. It's unified NATO the way it's never been before, not as a defensive force, which what it calls itself, having a point organized after World War II, but as an offensive force. Right from the beginning, it began to try and undermine Russia and reduce its power and reduce its capacities. Tell us about the expansion of NATO and how the Russian elites have both used it to solidify themselves and used it to develop this nuclear weapon capacity to wipe out humans on Earth even before climate change does.
Right. Well, NATO's expansion after 1990, when there was an opportunity as the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact came to an end, there was an opportunity at that moment to wrap NATO up. No longer served its purported purpose. And George Kennan, the architect of Cold War containment of the Soviet Union, predicted that the expansion of NATO would have disastrous consequences. So it's been a constant provocation. That is not to say, however, that anything that the United States or NATO, whatever, had done in the recent past provoked this particular invasion of Ukraine right now. Okay. I think there are people who, the most insightful observers of the Russian situation, like, for example, Boris Kagarlitsky, argue quite cogently that Putin's invasion of Ukraine right now was a response basically to a deteriorating economic and social situation inside Russia. However, NATO's expansion into Eastern Europe was provocative and sooner or later bound to produce negative consequences. Having said that, NATO is now the beneficiary of a crisis for which its own behavior bears considerable responsibility. Putin raised the demand that NATO step back from placing weapons in the Eastern European countries on Russia's border. Well, in response to this, NATO is putting precisely those weapons precisely in those places. That's not to say they're going to go to war with Russia, nor is Russia going to invade a NATO country. But NATO and its military budgets, that is, the military budgets of its constituent states, are expanding as a result of this. And NATO may expand further, particularly, I would say, if the Russian invasion succeeds in destroying or carving up Ukraine. I think you're going to see countries like Finland and Sweden rushing to join NATO. So this is an overall multifaceted disaster.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm KBOO, talking to David Finkel, the editor of the journal Against the Current, prolific writer, trustworthy analyst, hundreds of pieces in U.S. and international politics. We've just discussed the significance of this attack on Ukraine and its people, its heroic resistance. We've just discussed the consequences of it, one of them being the strengthening of NATO, and especially it seems to me, the strengthening of those forces who are not going to be satisfied just with humiliating Russia, which is dangerous in itself, but really sees the need for world supremacy. Anyway, my sense is that this is part of a U.S. drive amongst many elites in the U.S., particularly the old Cold Warriors who have been sort of sidelined for a while, despite their best efforts. Anyway, my sense is, as you pointed out, this really has world historic implications. But one of them is strengthening those elites who want to rule the world. And my guess is not only will the U.S. budget go up, but the Space Force that they just created and at least announces itself as the commander of space, as we know it, the satellite system, that whole system that circles the world and runs a lot of, that's very important in military and in just civilian and economic life. It seems to me we have to somehow come to terms with that drive for supremacy over economy and military superiority. What's your view?
Well, there is a struggle for the world. There's a struggle for the world. What has happened just now is that I would say Vladimir Putin has accomplished something that George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump couldn't. He's restored American leadership of the Western Alliance. And part of what happened here, I think it's been pretty well publicized, American intelligence, which had just a total debacle in Afghanistan when they simply didn't realize that the Afghanistan army was crumbling, they had a huge success in predicting Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Somewhat unusually, they shared that intelligence, as we now know, with Western allies, and they were able then to build up this unified front, which has resulted in enormous and rather unexpected unity around imposing really, really unprecedented sanctions on Russia, on an economy of that size. You would not have thought that Germany would sign on to this sweeping basket of sanctions. You would not have expected that you would see various Western political figures who have been put on boards of directors of Russian companies, that was one of Putin's ploys, are resigning en masse from those boards. You would not have expected American, you know, energy corporations to dump their investments in Russian oil and natural gas. I mean, you're talking dumping investments of tens of billions of dollars. You would not have expected that. So right now, American leadership, whatever we think of it, and I don't think much of it, is a big winner. Now, going into this, the biggest emerging rivalry, of course, is the U.S. and China. And how that will all shake out in regard to this, will China really step in to back up Russia in this economic war? Will they start purchasing all of Russia's oil, which I believe is being offered at a big discount? This all remains to be seen. And first of all, I'm not an expert on this stuff. And secondly, I believe the people who are real experts are saying that they don't know yet, that there's a lot of things that remain to be seen. People who make sweeping pronouncements are probably, at this point, not the best informed. However, looking at the overall geopolitical situation, the United States, or as some of us say, U.S. imperialism, is the world's number one superpower. China is number two and attempting to catch up and eventually surpass the United States. Russia, despite its military, is really a third and a half rate power right now that's trying to get back into second spot. And I think that this situation is going to hit the Russian economy and the Russian people very, very hard, and may very well wind up denting the image of their military prowess, because the invasion turns out to have been poorly planned and is going very badly and can now only be carried through by massive brute force, which means mass shelling and mass civilian carnage in Ukrainian cities. That's what we're actually right now looking at.
No one can predict what China is going to do, but it's very unlikely, it seems to me, that China is going to give up its claims to Taiwan and the South China Sea. They're not going to give up those claims, and yet the Taiwanese and others are not ready to yield to China, and the U.S. is backing them, and the U.S. is, in fact, U.S. destroyers, Navy ships, the biggest ones, nuclear-armed, some of them, at least the submarines are, who are also active there, are coming into very close contact with the Chinese Navy, which is growing, and all, and they certainly have nuclear capacity in that whole area, the Chinese. It seems to me we've entered now into a much more dangerous sort of, I mean, this war has now created a far more dangerous imperialist trajectory. It's given those who want the U.S. to be supreme a lot of momentum, and they are not going to give up. There's no reasoning with them. It seems to me we can say that's enormously dangerous, and it really requires a peace movement in the United States that can stand up to the U.S. imperialist momentum.
Well, I would say, first of all, that neither the U.S. or China have any intention of starting a war right now or in the short to medium term, and I don't expect either of them to do anything ultra provocative and stupid, although they're going to continue to, you know, probe and test and so forth. I think it's pretty clear that people in Taiwan who have struggled and fought their way to basically a democratic system after years of struggle against a pretty brutal dictatorship established by Chiang Kai-shek when he fled the mainland to China. But anyway, they have a democratic system now, and they see what's happened to Hong Kong. They see what's happening to Tibet and the Uyghurs and so on. And so I think it's quite clear that people in Taiwan do not want unification with China on anything like present terms. That doesn't mean that either the U.S. or China intend to go to war over it. It is a dangerous time. It's a very dangerous time. By the way, we're always under the danger of nuclear war as long as nuclear weapons exist. I don't think the danger of nuclear war right now is greater over Ukraine, for example, than it is any other day of the week, any other day of the year. I think that's an ever-present threat. I'm not more terrified of it now than I am any other time. However, we do need a strong and principled anti-war movement. We don't have that now. I would say the greatest peace movement in the world right now, let's be honest, are the people in Russia who are going out into the streets in a police state, you know, atmosphere to protest against the war. That is the world's leading edge of the peace movement right now. And we need to, you know, identify and really amplify those voices. That's the international anti-war movement that we actually have. Too much of the peace movement in this country, first of all, were not very strong, and many people got disoriented by more or less correctly understanding what's everything that's wrong with NATO, but not recognizing the kind of danger represented by Putin's aggressive nationalist chauvinism, which, by the way, if you really want to look at it in a broader context, what Putin represents is a species of white Christian nationalism. That's why the far right all over Europe and some of the far right in this country had gravitated toward Putin, although they have to change their stance now that Putin has invaded. But that's how you have to understand Putin and too much of the peace movement in this country. It's good they recognize that NATO is aggressive and imperialist and all the rest of it, but they didn't grasp the other side of the equation nearly soon enough, and some of them still don't.
Hey, Franco, we really do need the peace movement. I think that we're going to get a large enough peace movement. It'll have to be based on using the peace dividend, that is the vast sums around the world, and particularly the U.S., that dwarfs any other country, in fact, any other 10 countries, I believe, in spending on military hardware and all of the rest. A peace movement could combine with climate action movements to demand an end to the militarism and a realignment of the economy and public funding to deal with impending, looming climate disaster. My guess is, Dave, you agree with that, but we'll have another interview soon, though, talking about, again, some of the other implications of the war and, in fact, the potential for the U.S. and international peace movements. Dave Finkel, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Great. Glad to be here.